Hello, and thanks for joining us. You're listening to TaskCam On Air, the official podcast of TaskCam. I'm your host, Sean. Listen along as we explore podcasting, sound design, indie filmmaking, vlogging, recording, and more with a host of legendary TaskCam artists, producers, and other major players discussing their personal techniques and philosophies. Today, we're speaking with a Grammy-winning producer, composer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist who has worked with some of the biggest names in pop music. Please welcome KC Porter. So, KC, thanks so much for joining us here at TaskCam On Air, the official podcast of TaskCam. Glad to see you. For people out there who are listening to the show right now who maybe aren't aware of you for some reason, you've got 6 Grammys plus 2 Latin Grammys, and you've worked with a whole host of incredible artists, and I'll only name a few because the list is long, but Santana, Ricky Martin, Michael Jackson, Bon Jovi, and many, many others. Thanks for joining us and lending us your expertise. So how would you describe yourself? Do you consider yourself a producer, or are you a songwriter, an engineer? What do you consider yourself?
I'm a little of everything because I can arrange, I can sing, I can play, but it's just a little bit of everything. So don't ask me some deep engineering questions because my mind kind of stops when you start, you know, getting too technical. But I think it's a really good balance for me as a producer. It's great because I kind of can explain myself in sessions well. So that's helpful.
Let's kind of break down some of the things that you do here. So if people are out there looking you up on Wikipedia to get your list of records right now, they might see that you're a producer. So and I feel like with a lot of people who don't have a lot of big time experience, producer is kind of a bit of an ambiguous word. So when you're producing a record, are you sitting behind the console yourself, or do you have an engineer on hand that's doing the physical things and you're sitting there directing the song and saying things like, you know, the snare sounds too boxy, no, let's swap out that 1176C for a blue face, or like what are you doing when you are producing a record?
It really depends on the circumstance. I started out when I came to LA working with the top engineers. You know, we were at A&M Studios, so I started working with this young engineer, a guy named Benny Facone. Benny had been working with Bruce Swedeen and with Don Hahn and all of the A&M people, and so he was cutting his teeth, you know, in Studio B, and then We Are the World was one of the first things that he was kind of like an assistant on, and then he went on to become, anyway, I'm giving his life story, but anyway, but he was like, for me, was the engineer. So I was producer. So it was like, I was like Quincy with Bruce. It was me and Benny. And Benny went on to produce a lot of things for like Mana and whatnot. But I always stayed, you know, stayed in the producer role. But then there were times when I couldn't get Benny. Then I said, well, what do I do? You know, then it was like, well, I got to engineer myself. So I had to make sure I knew the basics about how to capture at least vocals. Now I would still track with an engineer. So it was like one of those things. So, and it gradually became like, well, actually, it's so much easier. Just I'm set up. It's all dialed in at my studio at home. So I didn't have to worry about that. But I still go to studios whenever I do drums. I try to leave that expertise to the great engineers. And what a blessing to be able to have worked with some of the greatest engineers, either in mixing scenarios, recording strings with Alan Seitz, or having Umberto Gatica mix a record, or, you know, Michael Brower, or, you know, I've just been, you know, so fortunate to work with so many great. So the mix engineering thing I stay away from. But still there, I think it's important for producers to understand that you still need to get the song pretty dialed in before you hand it out to the mix engineer. Because a great mix engineer has got his hands full, and it's more about the sonic integrity of like, how do we take this vision that's already kind of there and just raise it up to the next level? That's the same role as me as a producer. If a band comes to me and says, here's our music, I'm not going to look at it and say, like, let's reimagine this. Let's just do it all differently. It's wrong. It's more like, okay, I get your vision. How do I raise the level of that up? Yeah. You know, so we're still keeping intact all the crazy, you know, animation and life that you have in your music, and don't try to stifle that, because a lot of people will do that in the attempt to kind of put their brand on it, like make it my, to sound like Casey Porter. You know, I think it's important for me to adapt to them and still suggest, like, hey, it'd be great to have a string part here, or, you know, what about a little cello thing or horns or whatever, you know. So so we kind of go back and forth. So I started doing a lot of my stuff on my own, and then I started realizing, man, I'm bending my back, breaking my back, trying to get down there and patch that stuff in. And I said, you know, I need to step back again and let a good engineer do their work. So, and now my engineer, after COVID, he ended up moving back to his hometown in Latin America. And now I'm back in my studio alone. So I think we're all kind of like forced to kind of fend for ourselves. Anyway. Long story.
Well, you got my number, so when you need some engineer, I'll push some faders for you, man. I'll do that. Yeah, no, that's great. Like I said, you know, producer role is kind of ambiguous, and I love what you said. So any aspiring producers out there, do what serves the song, not your personal ego. Don't put your stamp on it. I love hearing people say that. You gotta do what's best for the song.
Although they may want your stamp, and then you sometimes wonder, well, what is my stamp in their eyes?
Oh,
you
know, sure. Yeah, that's a good point.
They're coming to me because I've done great things with Latin artist or R&B artist, or, you know, because I do dabble in a lot of different areas. Like Santana is totally different than Ricky Martin or, you know, Celine Dion or Mariah Carey. I mean, we have to figure out, why are they coming to me, you know?
Yeah.
And make sure we give them something interesting. Wow, man, I could talk forever, but
So another aspect of what you do is songwriting, arranging, composing. And so that is also, I think, a very interesting area, because if you're, you know, you're writing these songs for these artists or arranging, composing, you know, whatever. So when you start the process, are you, say, at home and you're noodling, or, you know, for not to downplay what you're doing, are you just, you know, playing around with a small idea and then it comes to fruition? And then when you go into the studio, you've got this big picture and everything's completed, or are you going to the studio with just an idea and then you're, you know, fluffing it up and filling it out, you know, from then forward?
Well, there's two different going into the studios. One of them is going to the studio in my house, and I can, you know, even though it's a big studio that's capable of everything, there's zero pressure. But when I go to Capitol Studios and we have a string date, I don't want any issues. I want to make sure that it's all done before we've already heard the mock-ups. We already have the arrangement, the charts, everything, because when it's like you're talking, you know, $5,000 for every 10 minutes or that kind of thing, you have to be, you know, ready to go. But in terms of ideas, developing ideas, I try to find the something usually the hook kind of thing, usually trying to find something that really, really gets me, you know, that feels like it's heavy enough, like an anchor for the song. Then I can work back into the verses and whatnot. The friend of mine always called it the fluff. The verses were like that, you know, but it's not necessary. I mean, sometimes the verses, your whole song could just be a lot of verse, kind of like linear, and not have this big explosive chorus. And I think that's something that we're kind of falling prey to, this whole notion that we've got to follow a format. And I think it's great when we see artists that are just really doing whatever they feel, and no one's forcing you to do an 8-bar phrase. It can be a 10 or 11 bar phrase if it feels right. But I think the more you listen to it, you come back, and luckily we can just save and close and open up another song. All of a sudden we have an instant, you know, multi-track in front of us with all these possibilities. And we have this new fresh perspective. And then we can keep on tweaking and say, oh, this is way too long. And I think that's the kind of the line that you cross from, like, when you're an amateur to a professional. I think the professional is someone who's saying, like, it's not right yet, and we're going to spend all the time in the world it takes to make sure it's right. The artist will appreciate that. the label will appreciate that. Because you, at the end of the day, as a producer, you're responsible to the artist. You know? And that's, you can't blame anybody. I learned that early on. I can't blame the engineer that the big engineer that I got, I won't even mention names, but you know, he said, "No, man, it's fine. The vocal's fine." I said, "I need more vocal." And he says, like, "Look, I'll give you a vocal up version and you'll be fine. Trust me. I know, you know, I've been doing this for, you know, whatever." Then I'm sitting in the car with the artist playing the song. And after I heard it, after the session was already over and they closed everything down, you know what I mean? I'm listening in my car. And I'm like, I got to play the vocal up version. I think vocal up version is what, a dB, you know? Now it's like, and I remember I'd always say, like, "Hey, can I get a vocal like half dB up and a quarter dB up?" You know, it was like, you know, ridiculous. And I know, and engineers would come in, they'd be like, "Dude, just go with 1, 2, or 3 if you want it," you know? But engineers would always have such a hard time. But I was such a perfectionist. I really wanted to be able to go in there and move, you know, and cut and paste and like figure out, you know, but that's stuff you just have to dial in. Now we have to dial in before we give it to the next engineer. But anyway, but I ended up playing it for the artist. And the artist said, "I like it, but my vocal's so low." And I was like, "Oh, I was cross." And all I could say was, "I screwed up because it was my fault. This guy was telling me, and I didn't listen to my gut, you know?"
Yeah. Part of that aspect in my mind is, you know, with this side, you know, songwriting, arranging, composing, you work with a lot of, you know, like American artists, and then you work with them to develop like Spanish language versions of their songs. In that role, you kind of like a vocal coach where this is the authentic way of, you know, singing this, or are you guiding the music a little bit too with that? How does that work?
You know what? Like, for example, with Toni Braxton, we did a number of songs with her. One of them was Unbreak My Heart. Or there was somebody, I think it was Toni or another artist that we kind of Latinized the music. So we might have, I think with Unbreak My Heart, we might have added even more of a Spanish guitar, or added maracas. I forget. Oh, I think it was a band called As Yet that Babyface was producing. And he said, "Hey, we want you to do this. We did a song called Last Night." And he was like, "Last night," like an R&B kind of thing. And I put in this whole boom, 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 you know, very bolero-esque. And there, and the song was Ayer. And so instead of Last Night, it was Ayer. Dun-na-na-na-na-na. So anyway, so we have to train the artist to sing the song in Spanish. And because Spanish was a second language for me growing up, I moved to Guatemala when I was 7. So I all of a sudden I was this gringo kid learning Spanish. So I know the things that we have to tell the artist to try to get your D in Spanish is more like a TH in English. You know, you say like verdad, verdad. This is like a TH, not like verdad, you know? And Toni Braxton really labored with the R's, and most Chaka Khan had a hard time with the R's because you have to roll the R's and no, you know, I'm trying to give you an example of it, but Toni Braxton started Unbreak My Heart with no me abandones así, hablando sola de ti. And hablando, she kept saying humblando.
Okay.
Humblando. Or Bon Jovi would always say like, la mañana es tan gris, like tan gris, like it's French. And it's tan gris, tan, you know, not tan. But he just kept getting stuck on French, and you know, Chaka Khan was pulling her hair out. She's just like, "Oh my gosh, this is so hard," just wanting to quit. And they would get mad, you know. Bon Jovi was like, "Do we really have to do this? Why are we even doing this?" And I told him, I said, "Well, there's like 600 million people in Latin America." He's like, "Let's go next day. Let's do it."
That's all it took. That's oh my goodness.
All it took, man.
I couldn't even imagine, like, for you know, these people who are at the top of the food chain in the United States with their, you know, uh-huh, music, having to do these other languages that they don't speak. That seems wild. So that's, I don't know. Yeah, kudos on you, because I've heard some of these songs.
I'm sorry?
I say kudos to you because I've heard some of these songs and they sound great. So,
well, yeah, I mean, that's where I think a perfectionist really comes in handy, because we do our very best to make sure that every word is right, even if it takes 100 tries, you know. And but like I was thinking of Boyz II Men, we did a whole album there. I think it's Evolution was the name of the album. And we had all of I'll Make Love to You, End of the Road, On Bended Knee, all those songs. And but the guy I would make these little cassettes, I believe, of of the songs with me singing on them, right? The guys would show up to the studio and I'd say, hey, so did you hear the song? What'd you think? You know, just and they're like, oh no, man. And they're like just exhausted. They're like, no, we haven't had a chance to hear anything yet. I'm like, oh my gosh. I was like laboring over this stuff to give them these things so they can learn it, listen many times and make it their own. So then I had to start from scratch in the studio and during, you know, following them on their tour. So after the day after their late night performing in Philly or somewhere, they had to sing and it wasn't easy, but we did it.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's man, yeah. that seems like a rough job. Rewarding, but I mean, that seems like that could be very hard. Piggybacking off that, like you're also a solo artist, correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
I saw that you had just earlier this year, you had a single come out. It was Viajando.
Viajando.
And so, and which is an amazing song. I really love the mood of that. I don't know. It's very beautiful.
It's a traveling song.
I'm not that great when it comes to speaking Spanish. I really try, but I'm just not there. But the song's beautiful, wonderfully produced. It's awesome. Is there a record following that up, or was this just kind of a one-off single for your solo career?
A one-off thing, yeah. I just did it for something else, and then I ended up saying, oh, let me just release this. And yeah, a lot of my previous album is also kind of like the Cruzanderos record is something that's just kind of like was honoring the immigrant's journey. So there's a lot of traveling still kind of like flowing through my being in terms of really thinking about all the immigrants and refugees on this planet right now that are kind of like in this state of flux, not really knowing where their home is, and people that are like not really understanding that all the people that are fleeing, you know, injustice or fleeing, you know, unrest or poverty or violence, they're just trying to figure out the way that we would try to figure it out. You know, it's like if you had a break-in in your house, you know, for a fact, your family, you'd have a little powwow and they'd be like, I don't feel comfortable in this house anymore. Can we move? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
everybody would unanimously be thinking about that, you know? So I think that's, imagine that happening every day. Your kids are, you know, walking home from school and there are people that are, you know, that are reaching out to maybe your daughter, like, hey, you got to come and be with the gang, or your son to be with the gang, you know, all of a sudden you're thinking like, I need to get up and get away from this. So it was just something that was really important for me to try to put that whole thing out there. It was in Spanish. So in a sense, I was preaching to the choir, but the idea of having many collaborators, we have Gabby Moreno, La India, Gustavo Santaolalla, you know, great, great artists, you know, Gianmarco, the Peruvian superstar that I ended up producing his next album after we did my album. And it's just great to be able to bring in some of the people that I've really admired over the years. I have worked with so many artists, and you never know who's going to be available or, you know, working with Santana, and then he just became so big. And then it's like calling. I mean, we were calling him every day. And then all of a sudden it was like, it wasn't easy to get him on the line, you know, and like much less to get him to sign a guitar, you know. But we had our nonprofit Oneness, whose main purpose was to fight racism with music, the arts and education. So we had auctions and big events and songwriter summits and things like that, which actually we're trying to kick off. Now, again, looks like we might be doing a songwriter summit in Africa next year. Just kind of the idea of using music to really promote racial unity. I really feel like we have so many resources, so many people that want to do good, artists that want to contribute. Like, what can I do? It's like, well, sign a guitar and send it over, and then we'll have an auction, and that'll help pay for events or, you know, get togethers where people can really, really start talking about these things and creating music. The Africa thing is taking musicians and producers over to Africa to mix with their top producer artists, really building a really beautiful cultural bridge and writing music that really, you know, speaks to the oneness of humanity in whatever way it comes yeah, to be.
That's beautiful. I'm glad you brought that up because actually I did want to talk about oneness. That's been about a little over 20 years since you guys have started that, correct?
Yeah.
And then I think that's amazing. And there's anybody listening should just check that out. Like, you know, quick Google search on that. And there's been some really beautiful, you know, things coming out of that. And it's all music related. The racial unity is amazing. Like where I wanted to, you know, I don't have a great grasp of all of it. So like when you're doing these things, so like then, you know, you're selling these like signed items or auctioning them off or whatever. And then there's a nonprofit. So then how does the money get funneled into, well, not how, but like where, like what kinds of projects are you specifically like, you know, looking to help out? Obviously racial unity and oneness, you know, but what kinds of projects are you guys helping out?
We were looking to promote or support any kind of endeavors where people were promoting diversity through their art. So we would, even if we have a book signing and book reading or whatever of an artist, you know, or an art gallery of an artist that's doing that kind of thing. I mean, just whatever, however we can put our, you know, our help towards that. It wasn't something, the fundraisers weren't something that were creating. Sometimes they were kind of helping just promote the fundraiser itself, which is not what you want, you know, but to put together a big fundraiser at the House of Blues, you know, and all that's involved in that, it's, unless you get everything donated, there are costs. But I think that it was a hard thing to have a nonprofit and do all the administrative stuff associated with a nonprofit. So, and I think it was because it was like 2000, 2001, 2002, it was a time when a lot of people didn't really feel any kind of an issue. A lot of white people didn't really see, like, what's the big deal? You know, I don't have a problem with racism, but you knew that there was this major racism issue that was bubbling under the surface for those who didn't see it. And for those who lived it, it was very apparent and very, very, to this day, extremely tiring to be able to, or to have to explain over and over again what's going on in, you know, in the community that is dealing with racism. But I feel like a lot of the African American communities are just saying, like, look, you started this racism. So you have to figure this out. You have to, and that really is, I think that's the responsibility that white people have, is to really try to, first of all, educate ourselves so that we're not having to, you know, tire out other people having to explain to us what is the outcome of all the things that our ancestors have done. It's not us. And I think we, most of us get that, but I just really felt, I had heard this lady talk. Her name was Joy DeGruy Leary, and she had written a book called Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. And her talks were so powerful, and her book was so powerful. And it was kind of telling the story of the Middle Passage and the diaspora of the slave trade, you know, all of these things that happened in that Middle Passage from Africa all the way to the America. And it just kind of hit me so hard. I said, I've got to do something with all the resources I have. I want to be able to call on Michael Jackson, Santana, whoever I know at the moment, and bring them in and say, hey, I know you guys are, you know, you stand with me in this whole thing. Santana would constantly talk about embrace your absoluteness, you know, about bringing the world together. And that was one of the things where we really clicked heavily with Carlos, was on a spiritual level. He really wanted to try to figure out how to get the music that was more spiritually elevated on the airwaves, you know, and So we were given like half the album. Clive Davis, Santana said that Clive Davis's album was like the brain of the record. It had, you know, it had singles and more directed to sales, right? And then our half was more like the soul of the record. So that was a really beautiful thing when the artist comes to you and tells you, first of all, I am so honored to be able to work with you. Oh my gosh, for Santana to tell me that, it's like, oh my gosh, no, are you kidding? You know, yeah. You know, yeah. And that was, you know, that's another thing, the humility of the artist that, you know, when you have an artist like Celine Dion who comes into the studio and says, if it's not too much trouble, do you mind if I take a few minutes to breastfeed my baby? You know, that level of respect for people, as opposed to just like, I'm famous and I can do whatever I want to do. And I'll show up late to the session. It's like very disrespectful, rude, but luckily I haven't had to deal with that kind of thing. I mean, there have been some divas, but I understand why divas are divas, you know, because they have, you know, they have to believe in themselves and they have to fight for all the things that are, you know, if there's a little buzz in the room, they're going to want to, why is there that buzz? You know, but that's what makes them divas, because they're perfectionists in their art. You know, I know I'm rambling all over the place. But,
no, not at all. Please go on. This is super fascinating. And I think that a lot of people out there are probably going to enjoy hearing this or maybe need to hear some of this, you know. But no, that's incredible. And yeah, I can't even imagine the amount of time and effort that it goes into putting something like that together. And it's awesome to hear that, like, those artists, like you said, have that respect for you and the project. And they're just like, let's do this. And then, you know, give it their all. And that's, I think that's amazing. And speaks volumes to you and your reputation as well. So,
oh, well, thanks. Yeah. Well, and it's something that I really feel that when we talk about the responsibility of an artist, I think it's something that we as artists need to take that seriously. We were given a gift, right? We were born with this gift. So if we're not honoring that, it's kind of like if you had a light bulb, but you just keep it in your pocket. Right. Yeah. You know, what's the point of having a light bulb if you just keep it in your pocket? You want to be able to use that to shine like areas that are, there's darkness in there. Maybe you'll find something great and shedding your light in areas where light is needed. You know, I think that's really important. And our responsibility to carry out a message. I'm always asking artists, any artist from Santana, who's already got so much message. Anytime you sit down with Santana, the first thing he'll say in the studio is like, let's spread a spiritual virus. You know what I mean? Really? We need to do this. We need to do that. And it was like, it's not like talking about what happened on the, you know, the last game last night, or, you know, there's none of that. It's just, it's really inspiring. And I think that we, as artists, we need to really look at that responsibility and do our diligence. We need to, I don't want to preach in any way, but I feel like that's something that I need to really try to do more of. Look at where needs are and how I can fill them in some way. Look at our brothers and sisters across the planet and really feel, you know, really try to feel more connected. And this whole Africa thing, I feel like a little crazy. Like maybe I'm out of my, you know, league in terms of, I don't know what's going on in Africa, but I just reached out to some folks. And before we know it, we've got a whole group of people that are talking about doing this thing. We've got a venue and I know it's going to happen. You know, and I really feel that maybe, who knows what'll come out of it, but any kind of encounter, just talking to you today, you know, we're feeding off each other and I'm going to walk away feeling inspired from this talk. You know, and hopefully other people may feel inspired too.
Well, you know? I'm feeling inspired right now. So I think you're doing a great job. I'm loving this. You got, you're very pleasant to talk to. You got great energy and it's all, I love it. I love it. But anyway, so let's, I know you got a session a little bit later today, you'd mentioned, or coming up around the corner here soon today. But so I won't keep you very much longer, but being that this is the official Tascam podcast and you're a Tascam artist, what was the first piece of Tascam gear that you got your hands on that you loved?
I was in Guatemala when I was 7. I had mentioned that. And we were in a studio there that had a Tascam machine. I don't remember I don't remember what number or model it was.
Sure, that's fine.
But I just remember from that early age, Tascam was just like, it became like this obsession with me in a sense. It's kind of like every time we drive by the on the freeway and we see TAC, the big TAC sign off right off the 5, I think it is, in Long Beach or somewhere. And I would just get like this feeling inside, like, that's TAC. Those are the guys, you know, those are the people that are making these amazing pieces of gear, you know. But anyway, but then I went to college and they had Tascam equipment there. And I got to LA, and this is for those who are, you know, fortunate enough to just be starting with laptops with unlimited tracks. We were, you know, the 2-track, 4-track, 8-track, 16-track thing was like, if you had an 8-track, you were like the luckiest person in the community, right?
Yeah,
you know. And I think that was when there was the Fostex and there was the Tascam, and those are the real to reels, you know. And then fast forward really quickly to like the DA88s and the ADATs and all of that, where everybody had their little 8-track modular 8-tracks. And I, of course, I there's no way I would have opted for an ADAT, but a lot of people had ADATs, and we were like Betamax, and what was the other one? I already forget the video cassettes. There was But we were divided. It was like Republican, Democrat, right? We were like, no way, man. I'm not an ADAT guy, you know? But so I had the DA88s.
Yeah.
And I was using the DA88s. Like, I love them. Locking and the sonics of those were amazing. And then I still have a DA98, which I use to make sure I have access to all the stuff that I did. There was an important time in my life when we made that switch over from 16-bit to 24-bit, and it was like the greatest day, because we bought the DA45HR, which is the 24-bit. I have it up there. I don't know if you can see. Anyway, you can't see. Anyway, but it's up there. But that was the two-track with little I think DATs. But when I heard the difference between the 16-bit and all of a sudden we listened to the 24-bit on the Tascam, oh my gosh, it was really like buttery, creamy, smooth, high resolution. And it just like even, you know, cemented my love for Tascam even more. So we used that for like all the stuff we were doing. So we were all the Ricky Martin stuff, Santana Supernatural, we were using the Tascams throughout that process. In addition to, I have a Studer A827, but because we needed to be able to travel these, I do remember carrying in some cases the heavy 2-inch tape, but having the DA88s was miraculous. So I've got boxes full of DA88s from those sessions. But anyway, and then there's all the new Tascam stuff too.
Oh yeah. This ton of new Tascam stuff. Let me rewind real quick. I just want to touch on something you just said. So as a youngster in Guatemala, were you in and out of recording studios, and you were recording things or being around that culture at the time?
Yeah. My dad, as an arranger, composer, musician, he was constantly recording jingles and different artists and whatnot. So I was always hanging around the studio with the most important engineer in Guatemala. And he was the biggest Tascam fan. I wish he just sadly passed away like a week ago. His name was Carlos Gamboa. And so he was the legendary engineer in Guatemala, such a purist and such a perfectionist as well. All the microphones in his studio were the top notch Neumanns and, you know, so he really instilled this whole thing of quality and excellence, as well as my father did as well. But you know, from a technical standpoint, Carlos was a big influence. And when I was young, I went to Gold Star Studios as well. I went to tons of studios, but it just sticks out. That was like the studio in the valley. That is long ago, you know, has disappeared, but so many artists had recorded there. And that was one of the biggest days of my life. I will never forget. You just know that you see the tape rolling and you're like, the smell of tape. You're like, that's what I want to do for the rest of my life, you know?
Love that. Love that. thanks so much for joining us, Casey. Yeah. It was great to have you. Thanks for sharing all of that insight, and then the socially conscious aspect of that too. That was incredible to hear. And you're a much loved part of the TASCAM family. So thanks for joining us, and I'll let you get off to make a platinum record or whatever you're about to do now.
Thank you, man. Yeah, pleasure being here. And yeah, I'm a big forever fan of TASCAM, and I don't say that lightly. I really mean it, because I'm excited about everything new coming out. I'm talking to folks at TASCAM. The Porta Capture is like the coolest thing, and I'm waiting for that to be available. I think it's the stuff for film and production, because I'm producing some videos as well. There's some really cool stuff there too. I think it's the undermount for like a camera where you have, it's just so well designed and beautifully designed. And the microphones, that you don't even have to be, the wireless kind of, not even wireless. They just lavalier mics. There's just some really cool stuff coming out. So I appreciate TASCAM in every way.
Good to hear. We appreciate you, man. Anyways, thanks for joining us, and have a fantastic afternoon.
All right. You too. Take care.